When Jones and the other investigators walk through the back doors, they might not immediately realize that the pale, shimmering mass, beyond the worst of the destruction, and away from the three hideously burned bodies, is actually another body, another girl. There will be much speculation about Amy's position and why she wasn't lined up with her friends near the seat of the fire. As a result, she was burned less severely, her skin blistered and raw but not charred. In the police photos taken from the back door, she looks almost like the distant ghost of a naked dead girl. On the street all the time. By the time Jennifer arrived home, the sky was dark. Greeting her mother, she looked quickly away and, after agreeing to drive Sarah and Amy to North Cross, rushed upstairs to change. Noting her evasiveness, Barbara figured she was keeping a secret that more than likely had to do with Sammy. Probably, she assumed, they were having sex, a suspicion confirmed when vaginal DNA swabs were taken and Sammy was questioned and then summoned to testify. Upstairs, Jennifer changed into work clothes. Both her bedroom and Sarah's were decorated with FFA and sports memorabilia, stuffed animals, school photographs, and country music CDs. On her wall, Jennifer had hung a collage she'd made of pictures of barrel racing girls on horseback that was captioned, "The Boots, the Jeans, the Dream." ICBY regulations required employees to wear Bryce's official open-necked knit polo shirt, white with pink and green trim and the company's logo, tucked into dark jeans and white or black athletic shoes. Once she'd changed, she tied her black high-top Reeboks, put on a jacket, grabbed her purse, and went downstairs. A young woman I met, Kate Wallace McClung, was 14 when the girls were killed. She and her parents and her younger sister lived on Janey Drive in the Allendale neighborhood, some 20 blocks from North Cross Mall. A bright, headstrong girl, Kate had cut a secret flap in her bedroom window screen so that at 11 on Friday and Saturday nights she could scramble out to the mall and, as a member of the Rocky Show shadow cast, dress up like Magenta and act out her part. "Kids were on the street all the time," she said. "Nobody thought anything about it." She was never afraid, even though some of the streets were heavily shadowed. In the coming years, new growth would push the desirable residential and commercial properties farther north and west, in the process stealing away not only many businesses, but also much of the resale value. In a rapidly growing city where real estate inventory is low, prices in this area temporarily stalled. Out to the north and west, the Domain Shopping Center, with Neiman Marcus, Tiffany, Ralph Lauren, and Louis Vuitton, had erased any chance of a North Cross revival. Even though each turnover or reinvention is cheerily announced in the Austin American Statesman and the Austin Business Journal as a makeover, North Cross is all but dead now. No anchor store, no movie theater, only a mattress shop, a guitar shop, a business center for annual meetings, a slew of beauty salons, a ballroom dance studio, and the ice rink. Everything else is gone. The once grand venue has become a beige creep show, so empty that when you walk the halls, your footsteps echo. Residents who tried to forestall the construction of a Walmart next door lost that battle, and the giant discount store is thriving. At 6:30, Eliza had arrived home and was getting ready for the short drive to the yogurt shop when her mother phoned to ask if Eliza wanted her to bring her a sandwich. Eliza was in an especially good mood because both she and Jennifer had been nominated for FFA Queen, but she wasn't hungry. After their brief conversation, she donned her ICBY outfit, pulled her thick dark hair into a scrunchie, and left home in time to make her 7 o'clock shift. She'd had a difficult time the previous night when she'd subbed for another girl, and her former boyfriend, Roger Kurduka, had convinced a pal to call the shop and ask about all the flavors of yogurt they had. Eliza could hear Roger in the background, laughing and making remarks. Something about the prank had really upset her, leading cops to consider Kurduka a possible suspect. But as John Jones says, back then we considered everybody a suspect. Around this same time, Jorge Barney was closing the party house for the night. He'd owned the store, previously called the Party Pig, for only 3 months and was working late in anticipation of the Christmas season. He already had a Santa Claus on his roof, complete with sleigh and reindeer. He then walked 3 stores down to Mr. Gaddy's for some takeout. Barney's office was in the back of the store, near the wall he shared with the yogurt shop's storage room, and that's where he would work on his books while watching a little TV and eating his pizza. How do we know all of this, and why does it matter what time anybody did anything, or that Eliza's ex-boyfriend was mad at her? We know because we're still trying to figure out what happened and who the killers were, how they entered the shop, where the exit point was, and because the state, in order to negate reasonable doubt, had to recreate, from police reports, a detailed timeline of the night on which the crime occurred. Everything matters, especially in a capital case. The fact that Jorge Barney ate supper at his desk while working on Christmas plans and watching a Cheers rerun mattered. He doesn't remember hearing pistol shots, but, on the other hand, was the first person to smell smoke and take note of the flames from the adjacent store. The layout of the yogurt shop's back room and the position of the bodies relative to walls, shelves, sink, doors, and one another will be of prime importance. Evidence is everything, Jones will remind his people, his job being to find, record, collect, and preserve. Eliza took the office keys from the cash register's ledge and walked to the end of the counter and through an open door on her left into the storage area. Past the 2 bathrooms, mop sink and walk-in cooler, she swung to the right and unlocked the ICBY office door. Inside, she laid her jacket, car keys, purse, and maroon and white Texas Aggie backpack on a filing cabinet, then locked the door behind her and retraced her steps. Following Bryce's rules, she put the keys back on the cash register, where they'll be found hours from now, long after the flames have been doused and the 4 bodies discovered. Once the girl finishing her shift had left, Eliza would run the store alone until Jennifer arrived at 8. Then they'd share responsibility. 10 minutes before the 11 o'clock closing time, they would lock the front door from the inside, turn the open sign to closed, and leave the key in the lock, even if last-minute customers were still in the shop. They would deposit the night's proceeds in a floor safe in the office and clean up, according to Bryce's precise schedule. When they were finished, they'd remove the key and lock the door again from the outside, then put the key in an envelope and slide it under the door where the manager would retrieve it in the morning. Because Eliza arrived first, she would run the cash register while Jennifer took orders. The tape in the machine, an old-fashioned paper roll, would record every transaction Eliza, cashier 13, rang up, including the last one of the night, a no-sale, at 11:03 p.m., some 13 minutes after the front door was locked, and 3 minutes after the shop was officially closed. In 2010, I talked to Peggy Sanders, the general manager of a locally owned coffee and tea store not far from Hillside Center, who spoke of the risks of working in retail, especially in small shops without a security guard. You never know who's coming in that door, she said. In her view, those little girls wouldn't necessarily have realized if somebody might be suspicious, or if it was okay to let somebody use the bathroom, or when, maybe, they should call the police. A late-night ICBY regular will echo her thoughts. Having noticed the lack of adult supervision, He'd often wondered if the girls who worked there were too trusting and naive to recognize a potentially dangerous situation, and if security shouldn't have been a pressing concern. All the West Anderson ICBY girls were close to the same age, 17. For Bryce, this was normal. When Reese Price began working there 7 years earlier, that's how old she was. Afterward, people did raise the issue of workplace safety. But back then, Austinites didn't worry that much about crime, and besides, this was a safe part of town. One hillside business didn't even bother to switch out a defective lock. Anyway, who was going to make trouble in a frozen yogurt shop? In a city that prides itself on its liberal, classless attitudes, the murders brought a few surprising opinions to the surface. "We never thought our daughters would have to have a job," one mother told me. "I felt bad for those girls that they did." "What were they thinking?" another woman wondered, "letting those little girls work by themselves after 9 when the other stores were closed. I would never have allowed it." Actually, Barbara Sarasi had encouraged Jennifer not to take a job during her senior year, to instead do wild and crazy things and have fun. But she wasn't surprised when her daughter insisted. "It's what we do in our family. We work. We build things. We have jobs." By 7:30, Sarah had donned a black denim jacket with a pseudo-Aztec lightning bolt across the front. As she and Jennifer headed to the S-10, their mother shouted out her usual, "Be safe!" And Jennifer backed down the driveway and drove toward Amy's house on Olin Road in a neighborhood of smallish brick bungalows on rather large flat lots, only 5 blocks from Burnett Middle School and 7 from West Anderson Lane. At the front door, Bob and Pamela Ayers had kissed their daughter goodnight and told her they loved her. Outside, they heard the lock turn behind them. Once her parents had left to go shopping, Amy packed her pajamas and other necessities in her Jiminy Cricket tote bag. When the S-10 pulled up, she emerged wearing her brother's leather bomber jacket, her turquoise Wranglers, and black lace-up boots. Her watch, her shrimp earrings, the 3-string friendship bracelets she never took off, and, around her waist, a wide leather belt threaded with multicolor lacing and fastened with a large heart-shaped buckle she'd borrowed from her mother. The buckle will be among the items of clothing found on the yogurt shop's floor, but neither the belt nor the bomber jacket will ever be recovered. Minutes later, Jennifer dropped the 2 girls off at the mall, and, after settling on a time and place to pick them up, drove past Hooters, Walgreens, and a number of strip shopping centers to the hillside lot, where she parked next to Eliza's Carmen Ghia and went inside, leaving Amy's tote bag on the seat. 4 hours from now, police will begin to figure out who the murdered girls are by examining registration papers in Jennifer's truck and Eliza's VW. A woman who worked at Suzanne's, an adjacent dress shop, described Jennifer and Eliza as squeaky clean. Another hillside shop owner called them innocent little girls. The day after the murders, John Jones sent a cop he considered the most cynical guy in homicide to examine the girls' bedrooms to see if he could find something indicating drugs, secrets, a bad guy boyfriend, uncle, or stepfather, anything at all. He came back shaking his head. "Those girls," he reported, "were pure. Both of them got good grades, had dreams of college, and were true to the popular image of middle-class Texas girls who loved animals, family, George Strait, Garth Brooks, and Western gear." Whether or not they became farmers, ranchers, or even veterinarians, thinking they might gave them energy and structured their lives. They wore their FFA jackets proudly, raised their animals devotedly, listened to country music, wore tight jeans with belts, rooted for the Aggies, liked their snap-button shirts tight and their jeans long enough to reach past the arch of their boots. Walking my dog along a leash-free trail on Austin's Red Bud Isle, I once ran into a man named Doug Tash, whose mother still ran a pet grooming shop two doors down from where ICBY used to be. "Oh, yeah," he told me. His family was in business when the murders occurred. Their shop had filled with smoke from the fire. A window got broken, and some cats they were boarding escaped. They managed to catch them, but it wasn't easy. "As for the girls," he said, "they were rednecks, you know. Their friends put FFA jackets on the caskets. I was there. I saw it." Tash went to a different high school, McCallum, where a lot of kids were more into acid than pigs. When subpoenaed as a potential witness, he asked the judge to release him. When Lynch asked why, Doug said, "I'd like not to be a part of this." "Kickers," another McCallum student called the girls. "You don't want to fool around with shit kickers." At North Cross, APD officer Malcolm Wilson moonlighted weekend nights as a uniformed private security guard. From 6 until closing at 9, he and his partner walked a regular beat. Around the concourse, outside to the parking lot, back inside. Shown photographs of Sarah and Amy, Wilson, who would soon play a significant role in the ICBY investigation, couldn't remember having seen them, probably because the mall had been packed with kids all night long. After the murders, a boy who knew Sarah from Catholic school would call the special APD tips line to report having seen her with Amy near the Hallmark shop. He didn't know Amy, but Sarah introduced them, then laughed about not having any money for Christmas presents. When the boy's mother showed up, everybody wandered away and he didn't see the girls again. He remembered the leather bomber jacket, but thought Sarah was wearing it, not Amy. And maybe he had it right. The girls might well have switched. Missing Boys. That same morning, at 8:44, about when the girls were entering their classrooms, Austin Teleserve received a missing person report. Identifying himself as Robert Springsteen Sr., the caller said he hadn't seen or heard from his son since 10 o'clock on Wednesday night, December 4th. The boy hadn't attended school on Thursday and wasn't there today either. Teleserve had been set up to field calls about minor incidents that didn't require sending out an officer, old burglaries, lost pets, missing adults. Sidelined from street duty by an injury, 10-year APD veteran Marianne Heskey took the call. Springsteen gave his address as 3839 Dry Creek Drive, apartment 129, and his date of birth, January 18, 1945. His son's name, he said, was Robert Burns Springsteen, Jr., known as Rob, whose date of birth was November 26, 1974, his address the same as his father's but one apartment over. He described Rob as 6 feet tall, slim, 150 pounds, light complexion, hazel eyes, brown hair styled in a buzz cut with a tail, a mullet. He then noted that Rob's roommate, Michael James Scott, was also missing. The two had been sharing the apartment for 3, maybe 4 weeks. The last time he'd seen Mike was also on Wednesday at 10. He happened to know that Mike's date of birth was February 6, 1974. After asking a few more questions, Heskey asked Mr. Springsteen to please call back if his son returned. He said he would. The officer filed the report. And that was it. There was no follow-up call on either side, and no way to know why Rob's father had added Senior and Junior to his and his son's surnames when legally they were the third and the fourth. Crime scene. The first report was made at 11:48 by Troy Gay, an APD rookie on DWI patrol, who, crossing Highway 1 on Anderson Lane, spotted a column of smoke rising from the hackberry trees lining Shoal Creek and drove toward it. When he came to the alleyway behind Hillside and saw yellow flames shooting out between two steel doors, he turned in. Beyond a blue dumpster, a man appeared in the next set of doors and waved him forward. When Jorge Barney saw smoke seeping around the electric panel in the north wall of his shop, he'd opened his back doors in time to see the police car edging toward him. Gay drove to the front of the strip center and called in a general dispatch. "Have a fire inside a business," he said. Unfamiliar with the neighborhood, he gave the wrong address, but his mistake was soon corrected by another officer, Dennis Smith, who headed to the scene. By then, the yogurt shop's window and the glass panes in the front doors were completely black, and smoke was pouring from the roofs of adjacent businesses. An ordinary kitchen fire, people thought. Somebody left a burner on, closed up the shop and went home. Happens all the time. Station 8 of the Austin Fire Department sent 4 units, an aerial ladder company, an engine company carrying hoses and water, an emergency medical service ambulance, and a battalion chief's car. A separate victims rescue team rode in a Chevrolet Suburban. Because the engine company's job was to make entry, find the fire, and put it out with the water and hoses, that unit parked closest to the shop, so that two of its specialists, Rene Hector Garza and David DeVoe, could quickly connect and charge the hoses. Once they'd done that, the two men, already dressed in turnouts and equipped with a handy pack radio, donned air packs, face masks, and gloves. Garza pulled on the front door, but the lock didn't give, so he used a crowbar to pop it open, and smoke banked to the ceiling and poured out. To get under it, he and DeVoe dropped to their hands and knees. After bumping headfirst into the service counter, they regrouped and crawled into the back room where they stood up and took in the situation. Garza. "We located the fire. We began knocking it down. We found the seat, went, and put the fire out. After we had knocked it down, there were some hot spots, just small bits and flames here and there. And once you put water on the fire, it creates steam, so it knocks down the visibility some." "The hottest flames," he testified, "came from halfway up the south wall of the storage room, where they assumed the stove was located." Hoping to ventilate the room, Garza had taken a tentative step into the darkness when he felt DeVoe's hand on his shoulder. Because of the masks and packs, the firefighters communicated primarily through gestures and touch. "DeVoe kind of shakes me," Garza remembered. "He's got a hand light. He points it at the floor." "Is that a foot?" DeVoe yelled through his mask. Garza looked down and then, to get a better view, stepped back and saw it too. "I proceeded to back up, you know, startled a little bit," DeVoe said. "And we found the second body." Garza told him to stay put. Outside in the staging area, where firefighters were climbing ladders and knocking open doors of the other businesses, he told his battalion chief what they'd found. "Two victims," he said. "Kids. Nude." When a member of the rescue team wanted to go in, he shook his head. "Let's not move them," he said. "Something is wrong." Then he walked toward the alley to try to open the back doors. Rene Garza will relive these moments at least 3 times. Once for the official AFD incident report, and years later, during the 2 trials. His testimony will be among the most compelling and moving the juries will hear, a tribute to articulate simplicity and honest recall. When he pushed at the back doors, they swung open easily, allowing smoke and steam to pour out. He looked inside. There was no kitchen, no stove. When he stepped in, he saw the lower half of yet another dead girl. Asked to describe his experience that night, Garza always said the same thing. "The foot," he said. "I remember the foot." Just as the battalion chief was telling the 2 policemen on the scene about the bodies, another cop, Joe Pennington, showed up, and the 3 officers entered the shop together. Once inside, they could see enough to verify the information, but the storage area was still full of smoke and steam, and without masks it was hard for them to breathe. So it was walk in, look around, walk right back out. Maybe a minute, minute and a half tops. That was when Gay called for a homicide cop. Two bodies, probable arson, probable homicide. This brought other policemen and an arson investigator. Having been released from further duty, Garza and DeVoe walked away together and sat talking in the cab of their truck until they felt ready to emerge, when they were reassigned. Cops hate arson. Any trace evidence left untouched by fire gets either soaked or washed away once firefighters arrive. John Jones knew all about this. 14 months earlier, barely into his second week in homicide, he caught his first case of arson murder after a man with a grudge over an $8 drug debt torched an apartment complex with a flare gun and burned it to the ground. It was nighttime, and people were sleeping. There were numerous injuries and two fatalities. One man suffered burns over 80% of his body when he carried his wife out through the flames and went back to find their baby. It was Jones who had to travel to the burn center in San Antonio to tell him that his wife and child were dead. What he didn't say was how long it took cops and firemen to find the baby's body. In a trial, crime scene photographs are called exhibits. They are not evidence, merely pieces of information that both the prosecution and the defense use to support their version of events. The position of the bodies, location and trajectory of wounds, fire damage to particular objects and burn patterns on the walls, blood spatter, fallen debris, the placement of ligatures, the tying of knots. These exhibits tell us how things looked afterward, leaving interpretation and imaginative scenarios to the viewer. For me, everything changed when I saw those photographs. After that, I understood why the firefighters couldn't bear to leave and why in the coming months, homicide would go all out in pursuit of Austin's self-proclaimed Satanists and devil worshippers. Garza said wrong. I thought evil, without knowing whether I even believed in it. As for Jones, he looked at the photos only once, a couple days after the murders. "I don't need pictures," he declared. "That scene is burned into my memory." Months from now, when a television reporter asks what he saw when he first stepped into the shop, Jones will give a quick answer. Wholesale carnage. But he's good at soundbites, and in person he agrees with me. The real horror, beyond the unspeakable condition of the bodies, was that the girls had become one with the scene, melted, merged, blackened, and all but indistinguishable from the fallen girders, insulation and soundproofing tiles, the exploded cans and spilled syrups, the wet black spatters of muck and char, the aluminum ladder missing its top two rungs, the metal shelves along the south wall, softened into swooping hammocks as if made of candle wax. "Everything looked black at first," he says now. "Except, of course, Amy." He shrugs. "But that's fire." My grandson is a welder. To determine the composition of the shelves, I showed him a photograph. "Stainless," he said. "Standard restaurant supply. But wait." He took a breath. "Is that a body?" It was Jennifer, burned beyond recognition. I shut down my computer screen. Ignoring the firefighters who either milled around or just stood there looking down, Jones stepped gingerly around the bodies. Having been schooled in evidence collection and processing, he felt competent to handle 95% of most crime scenes, but this one lay well beyond his expertise. In a memo to the DA's office, he will describe the situation as robbery plus sexual assault plus multiple child victims plus bondage plus gunshot wounds plus fire slash heat slash smoke slash water damage plus no known witnesses equals the homicide, arson, and DA's worst nightmare. In old-school police work, a lead cop struggled to solve the crime on his own. From the beginning, Jones knew he needed a team, and he needed experts. But an officially sanctioned task force wasn't easy to come by, and besides, protocol said he couldn't make significant decisions without the approval of a unit supervisor, either Senior Sergeant Hector Polanco or Lieutenant Andy Waters. Since Polanco was out of town, he called Waters, who quickly dressed and headed over. Awaiting him, Jones began snapping black and white Polaroids, as he'd been taught to do when processing a fire scene. By then, longtime AFD arson investigator Melvin Stahl had arrived and was also taking pictures. But, according to Jones, "We were photographing for different reasons. He was looking for signs of arson and to find out how the fire started and progressed. I was trying to solve a crime." In his official report, written Saturday, December 7th, Stahl would estimate that the fire had been set somewhere high along the south wall of the storage room, toward the east end of the steel shelves, at approximately 11:42, 39 minutes after Eliza rang up, "No sale." Your Yogurt Girl. In many instances, to write about a murder is to write about a trial. Consider O.J., or Lizzie Borden, Ted Bundy, Smith and Hickok, McVeigh, the West Memphis Three. Information comes slowly but in minute detail. In this instance, precisely at what time did you arrive? Who else was there, and who arrived next, and when exactly? Can you describe the path of the bullet and tell us about latent fingerprints, blood spatter, backdraft, accelerant, fire science, flashover? How do you know the girls were dead before the fire was ignited? Can you explain that for us? From testimony and transcripts, we learned things. The woman who heard the dog bark at the very instant forensic investigators say the knife sliced across Nicole Brown Simpson's jugular. The bloody dress taken from Lizzie Borden's washtub. Carla Faye Tucker's taped boast that murdering victims with a pickaxe gave her sexual satisfaction. "I come with every stroke." The celebrated expert witness who helped convict the West Memphis Three by citing examples of Satanism among fans of Iron Maiden and Metallica. From photographs of the accused, by checking out the look in their eyes for signs of otherness and guilt, we make judgments. From all such fragments, we can create a story that after a while seems real. We think we were there. If the victims are all dead, how else could we know? The hillside parking lot extends for a city block and can accommodate about 200 cars, with an additional 4 or 5 head-in spots in front of each business. But by 8 o'clock, when Jennifer began her shift, only Sun Harvest, a large natural foods grocery store, Mr. Gaddy's, and the yogurt shop remained open, so there was plenty of space. At 9, Sun Harvest, now called Fresh Plus Grocery, would close as well. Between 8:15 and 8:30, 51-year-old Lucella Jones parked in one of the ICBY spots and got out. A resident of nearby Allendale, she'd come to get a quick takeout for her husband, who'd had dental surgery and could eat only soft food. By then, the four girls' parents had relaxed into their normal Friday night routines. Barbara and Skip Sarasi had eaten a quiet dinner and retired to their bedroom to watch television. Mike Harbison was in New Boston with his second wife, Debbie. They had no children of their own. When Maria Thomas got off work, she drove to the HQ Fitness Center on Far West Boulevard, hoping to do a short workout, before dropping by the yogurt shop to say hi to Eliza. Having finished their shopping, Bob and Pam Ayers returned home with Sean's Christmas watch and new jeans and a fancy belt buckle for Amy. James Thomas, a social worker, and his second wife, Norma Fowler, a University of Texas economics instructor, were attending a graduate student party, but planned to leave early and pay Eliza a visit at work. Because Sonora was home alone, they wouldn't stay long. Heading inside, Lucilla Jones noticed only two other vehicles in the lot, Eliza's VW and Jennifer's S10. Had she bothered to look through the ICBY front window, she could have seen the entire service area, booths, tables, chairs, customers, the toppings display and yogurt machines, the girls working there. To the right of the window were two heavy wooden doors with plate glass inserts. The left-hand door, bolted shut with top and bottom sliding locks, held product display posters and a cardboard open sign. A frequent customer, Jones went in through the other door. The interior had a cheerful southwestern look, with dark red Mexican tile floors and walls lined with light oak-toned wood paneling. Along the north wall were three booths covered in forest green vinyl, each with a blonde wooden chair at the end. There were five more booths against the south wall, and in the middle of the room, three tables. The serving counter extended from the cash register on Jones's left to within 5 feet of the other wall, where there was a freezer chest filled with prepackaged cakes, pies, frozen yogurt sandwiches, and treats for special occasions. Beyond the space at the end of the counter, an open door led into the back room. Today, the storage area is pretty much as it was then, an open space sectioned off into partitions using fake or stub walls. Dark, efficient, windowless. Smaller than you might think, given the events that took place there. Eliza stood behind the cash register while Jennifer manned the toppings display. Chocolate, hot fudge, caramel, strawberry, cherry, carob chip, chopped nuts, M&Ms, granola, chunks of syrupy fruit, aerosol cans of whipped cream, as well as the five large dispenser cans on a shelf behind her, each filled with a particular flavor of yogurt. The chocolate and vanilla cans sat side by side with a common spigot that delivered ICBY's favorite selection, the vanilla chocolate swirl. As the door closed behind her, Lucilla Jones came to an abrupt halt. Only two other customers were in the shop, teenage boys who'd taken the table nearest the door and were focusing intently on something between them, a small sack of some kind. One sat with his back to her, leaning on his elbows and slumped over the table, while the other stood behind it, facing her. Something about them unnerved Jones, though she couldn't say exactly what, only that she felt immediately fearful. They were, she testified, probably between 14 and 17, and had a kind of hippie look. The one facing her was between 5'4" and 5'7", had medium dark hair, and weighed something like 130 to 140 pounds. She wouldn't call his hair messy, but it certainly wasn't clean-cut. Since the other boy never turned around, she couldn't describe him at all. As for ethnicity, they were possibly Hispanic, but may have been Anglo. Dark-skinned, in other words, in a white neighborhood. When the standing boy stuck his hand down in the sack and stirred it around, there was, Jones said, a clicking sound like marbles striking one another, or coins, maybe keys. There was no sense to it. For one thing, Jones told a BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, agent who was trying to help her analyze her suspicions, neither of them appeared to be eating anything. In the next moment, however, she modified her statement. "I don't remember," she said, "any containers on the table." And then she softened her certainty again. "I did not have a clear view of the entire table." Pulling herself together, Jones eventually moved past the boys to the counter, where she ordered a fresh strawberry sundae from Jennifer, then went to the cash register to pay. She remembered wondering if maybe she should ask the girls if they were okay there by themselves, or if they wanted her to call somebody. But Eliza and Jennifer were chatting happily, and so Jones figured perhaps her premonition didn't amount to anything. She paid by check, took her sundae, and left without looking back. Memories fungible, eyewitness accounts notoriously unreliable. People call in a tip or show up at a police station for many reasons, one of which is to contribute to the righting of a wrong, which sometimes causes potential eyewitnesses to embroider or imagine particular details in order to shape events to match either what they think happened or what somebody else had reported or suggested. Knowing this, cops withhold certain details, hoping a witness will cite them without being prompted. By the time Lucilla Jones testified in 2001, her memory had sharpened enough that she could come up with previously unmentioned details, one of which was that the standing boy had rolled his hand around inside the sack in a threatening manner. This, in retrospect, made her wonder if the clicking she'd heard hadn't been marbles, but bullets. What she emphasized most strongly 10 years later was a sense of foreboding, a feeling that these boys were up to no good. It could well be that the more Jones concentrated on dredging up her memories of that night, and the more she told friends and family about being in the yogurt shop only hours before the girls were killed, the more positive she became of the boys' ill intentions. By 1999, when police arrested the four young men and the mayor said that we could now begin to heal, she might have come to believe she had a duty to help put them away. At both trials, she gave a partial description of the boy who'd sat with his back to her. He was, she said, older than the other one, with a broader, thicker physique. But who knows, maybe her instincts were correct. Maybe they were about to make trouble, perhaps even to tie up the girls and rob the store. Or possibly they were just fooling around, making pests of themselves, as bored young slackers often do, if only to attract notice. All Lucilla Jones really knew was that they weren't the kind of boys she was used to seeing at the yogurt shop, and that they weren't from around here, either. After midnight, when police collected evidence, they found her check in a money bag inside the cash register drawer, right where Eliza had put it. At about 9, Jennifer drove to North Cross to pick up Sarah and Amy. Back at Hillside, the two younger friends went to get takeout pizza before Mr. Gaddy's closed at 10. We are 2 hours and 42 minutes away from the fire. The gym had closed by the time Maria Thomas got there, so she drove on to the yogurt shop. When she arrived at about 9:30, Eliza was on the phone trying to convince her little sister to ride her bike to the shop. But Sonora couldn't leave without her father's permission, so Eliza handed the phone to her mother and went back to work. Soon afterward, Sarah and Amy returned with their pizza, opening the box on the table between them. Other customers will have a vague recollection of two girls with long hair sharing a pizza, nothing more specific. This might have been because the girls were so wrapped up in each other that they were, in effect, absent. Maria ended her conversation with her younger daughter and went to the cash register to confer with Eliza. This information comes from Maria's testimony, with backup from James Thomas and various other customers. When the ICBY phone rang, Jennifer rushed to answer it, knowing it was Sammy calling to make breakfast plans for the next morning. Later, once news of the murder spread, reports of suspicious persons and vehicles streamed into Homicide. One woman said she had been at the shop 4 days prior to the killings at about 4 in the afternoon, when a tall, thin young white man walked up to the counter but did not act as though he wanted to order anything. About 23 years old, with wavy shoulder-length blonde hair parted in the middle, he stood beside the freezer display, looking not at the frozen pies and cakes, but at the door to the rear of the shop, which everybody knew, by the time this woman called, was where the murders had taken place. Anyway, he finally, with much indecision, placed an order. Still, his skittish ambivalence had made the caller feel so jumpy that she decided to leave. Driving out of the parking lot, she saw him again, getting into a light-colored vehicle, either a big car, perhaps a Delta 88, or a small pickup. Another woman said that on the night of the murders, she'd seen several dubious-looking people outside the shop between 6 and 9 o'clock, but she was unable to offer a description. A couple called in about a questionable van, and so did another man, who said the van was white. Somebody else saw a boy on a skateboard rolling around the parking lot, alone and late in the evening. Between 9:30 and 10, Darrell Croft, a 52-year-old former military policeman and current owner of Longhorn Security Company, parked his company car, a tan Ford station wagon with a rack of blue warning lights across the roof, in front of the party house. After dining at Fuddruckers, he and two female companions had gone to ICBY for dessert. After the women told him what they'd like, Croft entered the shop alone and surveyed the place, the girls behind the counter, Maria by the cash register, two young people, a boy and a girl, sitting in a booth along the right-hand wall, another couple standing close to the counter, studying a wall menu, and just behind them, a fidgety young man in a green jacket that might have come from a military surplus store. In his early to mid-20s, medium build, 155 to 170 pounds, maybe between 5'10 and 6 feet, he was white like everybody else in the shop. Having spent most of his life in law enforcement of one kind or another, Croft prided himself on his ability to note aberrant behavior, and right away he thought, or remembers thinking, there was something odd, something off, about him. Having made their decision, the couple studying the menu moved forward and ordered. The jittery young man was next. Croft was a regular at the yogurt shop, and, like Maria and Eliza Thomas, belonged to the HQ Fitness Center where he'd once run into them in the co-ed steam room. "Hi," Eliza had said. "I'm your yogurt girl. Remember me?" Like most people who hold security jobs, he believed in order and his responsibility to enforce it upon a sometimes resistant populace. When the fellow in the green jacket hesitated, instead of moving to the counter, Croft took a step toward him. At that, the young man turned around. "Was that his car out there?" he asked Croft, with the lights on top. When Croft said yes, he asked, "Was he police? Security? What are you?" His voice was deep, clear, and distinctive, which Croft found unusual for someone in his 20s. In interviews, he will sometimes mention a long, pointy nose. He thought it odd that this screwball guy would have noticed his car in the first place, and who did he think he was asking what he was? But he held his tongue, avoided confrontational eye contact, and said only that he owned a security company, at which point the fellow turned back around to find Jennifer urging him to come forward, so he moved up and asked for a 7-Up. When Jennifer said they had only Sprite, he said okay, so she put the can in a paper sack and handed it to Eliza to ring up. Croft moved to the counter and gave Jennifer his order. But before he got to the cash register to pay, the unpleasant youth had gone around the end of the counter and through the door to the back room. Unaware that customers were allowed back there, Croft asked Eliza where he was going. When she said the bathroom, he told her he didn't know they had one, and Eliza laughed. The bathrooms weren't really open to the public, she explained, but the guy said he had to go, so she let him. It's not clear why Eliza said that, or even if she did, because, as she well knew, the ICBY shop had two bathrooms, as required by city regulations, one for men and one for women, both open to the public. But that's what Croft remembered. Stalling for time, hoping to get another look at the nervous stranger, he initiated a conversation with Maria about the gym. Once he'd paid his tab and Jennifer set out his 3 cups of yogurt, however, he had no choice but to head toward the door. Before he got there, Eliza stopped him. "Darrell," she called, "your yogurt?" Rattled, he went back, and they all laughed. The next day, Croft drove to Houston for a football game. When he got home Sunday, he read about the four deaths and went immediately to the yogurt shop to tell a policeman about his experience and to sign an official APD incident report. Knowing that policemen generally regard the testimony of wannabe cops with suspicion, I asked Jones what he thought about Croft's account. Was it reliable? After hesitating a moment, all he was willing to say was, he was okay. He didn't hurt the investigation. 2 years later, in an attempt to mine his memories for more specific details, Croft will undergo voluntary hypnosis to no avail. In 1999, after the arrests, a homicide detective will show him a four-page photographic lineup of possible suspects, but he will not identify any of them as the snarky fellow he encountered. A few minutes after Darrell Croft drove away, Maria Thomas left as well. Almost immediately afterward, James Thomas and his wife dropped by. Business had slowed again, giving Eliza an opportunity to tell her father and stepmother about an economics class she was taking. Thomas recalled seeing two girls in a booth with a Mr. Gaddy's box on the table between them, but he hadn't ever met Jennifer's family and had no idea who they were. Neither he nor his wife remembered a young man in a green jacket. They stayed about 15 minutes, maybe 20. During the next week or so, a number of others will call the special APD tips line to report having been to the yogurt shop between 9:30 and 10:30. Two African-American women in their late 20s, there for maybe half an hour. Two male-female couples who lingered over their yogurt for some time. Regular customers Joseph Sauter and Eva Reed, who entered the shop at about 10. Jennifer and Eliza talked with them about their FFA projects, and both seemed to be in their usual good mood. At 10:30, a customer became uneasy when she saw a white or Hispanic man sitting in an older white vehicle in front of the shop, not doing anything, just sitting. When this customer went back out, the white car was gone. Another couple claimed to have seen a suspicious van in the lot between 10:30 and 11. McCallum kids sneered at these nervous reports. They knew things their parents and other people didn't, like how high school boys hung out with armed skinheads down at the skanky field they called the Fungus, many of them dropping acid and even doing heroin not just there but in the North Cross parking lot and all around Shoal Creek, Hillside, and Allendale. Young kids, 13, 14, girls, boys. So what if a kid rolled marbles around in a sack? Or even bullets. The neighborhood wasn't as white bread predictable as folks thought. We did everything, says Kate Wallace McClung with a smile. The streets were safe, so kids roamed around at all hours doing all kinds of things. Once the four young men have been arrested, Darrell Croft's description will hew more closely to the appearance of the suspect thought to be the ringleader. Maybe that jittery guy was smaller than he thought, younger. No pointy nose or mature voice. In her testimony during the second trial, Maria Thomas will add to her memories a young man in a green jacket who was acting strange. Working in his back room, Jorge Barney thought he might have heard something on the roof at about 10:30 and halfway remembered that, worried about his Christmas decorations, he had gone outside to check. But later he wasn't sure whether he really did, or for that matter, if he'd heard anything to begin with. What do we actually know, and how do we know it? Neuroscience teaches us that our brains are never still, even when we're asleep and have plunged into dreams. Neurons still continue to spark and fly, jumping synapses, digging up memories, creating new ones, adding, subtracting, removing, revising, until the story feels right, correct, what we want it to be. At 10:42, 18 minutes before closing time, Eliza will ring up the last real sale of the night. The couple who placed the order, Tim Stryker and Margaret Sheehan, had been to a movie and were stopping by for dessert before heading home. Entering the shop, they noticed only two other customers, large people in hooded jackets sitting across from each other in the last booth on the left, closest to the cash register. Eliza, the girl with the gorgeous eyes, stood alone behind the counter, Jennifer having moved into the dining area to wipe down the tables, turn chairs upside down on top, two facing diagonally on the tables and one at the end of each booth, and refill the napkin holders. Sheehan ordered a small cup of vanilla with carob chip topping, and once Eliza handed it to her, went to the booth next to the one already occupied to wait for Stryker, who hadn't yet made up his mind. For no important reason, she sat facing the front of the shop, so when looking up, she saw herself reflected in the plate glass window, and behind her the people in the next booth. She couldn't really describe their facial features or even accurately pinpoint their gender, though because of their size, she assumed they were men. The one sitting with his back toward hers was larger and his jacket, either khaki-colored or beige, was padded. The other had a thinner build and light brown hair. She sensed something odd about them, nothing she could articulate, but since they leaned across the table to huddle close together, she thought they might be homosexual. Tim Stryker eventually ordered a large cup of vanilla with hot fudge topping, and, after paying the $4.42 tab, sat down across from her. Neither of them noticed Sarah or Amy. Later, the pizza box will be found in the back room on a table adjacent to the big sink, where someone had begun washing utensils and topping containers. Presumably, the girls had taken the box to the back and started doing dishes. There is no chance of knowing this absolutely. Stryker thought they should take their yogurt and go, but Sheehan wanted to finish hers inside. When questioned, she remembered Jennifer and Eliza discussing the upcoming week's schedule and a friend they hadn't seen lately. She had a feeling the men in the hoods were listening as well. Something about their stillness. Neither she nor Stryker recalled seeing any food on their table and were pretty sure they weren't eating or drinking anything. Minutes later, Stryker upped his argument. Since the girls were cleaning up, they should get out of their way. This time Sheehan yielded, but as they left, she checked her watch, and it was 10:47. Out front, she noticed a green car, maybe Eliza's Carmen Ghia. Under hypnosis, she said she'd seen the same car when they arrived. When asked by APD about Eliza's temperament and habits, a co-worker recalled her strictness about following Bryce rules to the letter when she was in charge, especially when it came to cleaning up and closing. Therefore, soon after Sheehan and Stryker left, one of the girls, almost certainly Jennifer, must have locked the front door with a single key and turned the open sign around to closed. Because she'd already wiped off the tables, she then pulled a step stool close to the big silver swirl dispensers so she could remove the lids, drain the yogurt, and bend into each can to clean and sanitize it. When the shop manager took stock of the dining area the next morning, she could tell investigators exactly how far the girls had proceeded before they were interrupted. Jennifer's back was to the front door. Close to or behind the cash register, Eliza was running a rag over the counter when something happened. An unexpected something. She lifted her hand, left the rag on the stainless rim of the serving area, and didn't pick it up again. Early the next morning, once the bodies had been taken to the morgue, investigators took pictures of the rag, piled up unevenly, shaped by a hand, and the cash register tape, and the open vanilla yogurt dispenser with the stool pulled up to it. The drawer of the register was open, but the till had been removed and was now lying on the storage room floor beside the place where Amy Ayers' shoulder had been, with coins scattered around her face. At 5 or 10 minutes past 11 on the night of the killings, Kate Wallace McClung had walked down Rockwood Lane on her way to North Cross Mall. Looking to her left, she'd noticed the lights were still on in the yogurt shop. Unusual, she thought. And then, not wanting to be late